somewhat limited. Using a powered USB port, depending upon the design, you could juice it with 60, 70, 80 watts of electricity if you need it. So that's the difference. If you have an external power supply, the way that it's wired, it will take the power from the external power supply and not suck up any current from your computer. It's the nature of USB ports, though, that some are designed for different amounts of power transfer. So it's theoretically possible to get a port that will only give you a 5 volts at 1 watt, and that it's self-limited to that. So even if you plugged in a 60 or an 80 watt wall wart power supply, those chips would only go that far and then limit the current. So you have to look into the design of a given hub. A lot of times hubs will have multiple ports, but they're not all for the same purpose. They might have 4 or 6 ports that are for computer input output and general use of devices. And then there might be a charging one that's able to offer higher currents and higher voltages with the proper handshaking. And they'll usually ID those extra high power ports. So it's kind of an individual thing based upon the chipset used and the engineer's intent.
Got it. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome, Rich. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limewalk Technical Net. If anyone has any technical questions or comments or topics for discussion, please feel free, hit that push the talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
RNQ.
KG2RY.
Okay, David, you doubled with someone else. The other person, please ID.
Hey, this is John, November, Quebec, 1 Uniform.
Okay, John, what's your question for tonight, or your topic?
Well, I can wait till Dave goes. I'll wait. Double with him, go first.
Okay, then it's your turn, David. KG2RY.
Don't worry, Roy. It'll be very short. What to do about a switching power supply that is noisy? Known to be noisy. What can you do?
Well, I'm assuming you mean electrically noisy as opposed to audibly noisy.
Well, some power supplies are noisy to create some kind of interference inside the radio. You know, some of them are quieter, but the one that I have, it's someone recommended it to me a number of years ago, and I thought he knew what he was talking about, so I bought it. It's a Alinco DM330MV switching power supply, and how to say noisy power supply. Go ahead.
Okay, I mean, I was just trying to get, because theoretically, you know, if you put your ear, say, to a power transformer, not that I suggest that you do that, you'll hear a 60-cycle hum coming from it. There's a little bit of acoustic noise from some transformers. So you could have an acoustically noisy power supply, which is separate than an electronic noisy power supply. Well, the problem would then be that there's something going wrong with the smoothing circuits of that given power supply. It might be a faulty capacitor. You would have to kind of go in there and take a look-see what looks like it's dried up and kind of not quite working right, you may need to remove a capacitor and test it and replace parts that aren't working. But that's assuming that the noise got worse as time went on. If the noise was always there, then it just might not be as well designed as it should. Although Elinco makes reasonably good equipment, so unfortunately, probably you own it far longer than the warranty, so it probably expired. But if it's a progressive problem that you've noticed, I would take a look inside if you feel comfortable and check out the capacitors at least.
Well, my friend said that I should try ferrite. Ferrite core on the power cord and ferrite, smaller ferrite construction on the cord going from the power supply to the radio. He said he wouldn't sell them. You know, he thinks that they're really badly made.
Okay, like I said, know a lot of people with Elincos. They like them. They use them. Ferrite, I don't know if they would be terribly useful. What they do is they reduce a common mode current. So if you have a common mode current going through your power reel, then it could block that. If the problem is primarily just the smoothing circuits are not smoothing correctly, I don't think a ferrite is going to give you that much relief. They're relatively cheap and easy to try out. I have at one time or another, when I've had difficult RFI problems, placed chokes all over the place, and then after I figured out that that wasn't the solution, removed them and put them back in my little RF choke jar and for another rainy day. So it doesn't cost you anything, assuming you have ferrite's always nice things to have around the house for a ham, because invariably you're going to come a time when you're talking on a microphone and someone tells you it's picking up RF, and they tell you then to twirl a coil around your hand a few times, kind of a poor man's choke. And then if that works, they tell you to get some RF chokes. So it's always nice to have a couple of ferrite chokes available just for testing purposes. But I don't know. I wouldn't take the bet that that's going to solve your problem.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
I've been learning a lot tonight. What a terrific conversation. Interestingly enough, right now I'm working on an exact same Elinco DM330MV, and it works absolutely beautifully, quiet, and does its thing. I was actually wondering, at the start of this whole conversation, if I could use an auxiliary unit in a different part of my property with a cheaper power supply, which kind of led to learning about this stuff. But it's interesting to hear different opinions, but a lot of same opinions at the same time. I believe that Elinco probably is defective because this one works beautifully. Any thoughts? Over to Roy.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Jim. As I said, I know a lot of people with Elincos. I don't recall much of any complaints, but things break over time. It is possible that one of the smoothing capacitors in that circuit block are aging prematurely and need to be replaced. Things don't work forever. Even the best of stuff eventually breaks. So, again, I don't think it's an inherent limitation that should stop people from buying switching power supplies, unless you really want an army tank sitting in your shack. But things do break and have to be repaired. So although I would agree with David's friend to try the choke, if anyone was taking odds, I would say the odds are rather high that that's exactly what's going on. But I sort of knew this was going to happen, Jim, because there's a couple of topics that are big discussion points when you go down to 75-meter land. And one of them is switching power supplies versus linear switching supplies. Another is, are antenna tuners really useful, or are they just a con? There's a whole bunch of topics that 75-meter people can spend the rest of their lives arguing on that band.
I'm looking forward to doing some talking on 75. Is it a technical thing that causes that, or is it a cultural thing that you're speaking of? I didn't quite catch which one it was.
It's pretty much a cultural thing. Different bands have different qualities. 80 meters is one of those nice bands that if you're an insomniac in the middle of the night, it gives you good propagation a lot of times. And so there's a whole bunch of cranky guys out there with their foot up on a soapbox chatting away on 75 meters. I think you'll enjoy it. You know, there's all different kinds of people. So, you know, some might, you might not agree with the attitudes of some little groups. And they can be a little cliquish, unfortunately. But they're certainly interesting to listen to. And if you find one that sounds friendly, you can at least try to enter and hope that they'll be kind to you.
One more comment, and one whitey white.
Yes, Hank.
So my original Elmer was of the opinion that you shouldn't use any power supply. You should have a bunch of 12-volt batteries in parallel in your garage and a wire that ran into your shack. And so when I was originally on 80 back in the day when I lived someplace else and had room for the antenna, I was told that they could hear the noise of my power supply. And one day I went out and got a couple of batteries, and I was still told they could hear the noise of my power supply when I got on the radio that night.
Comment?
Yes, Ed.
If he was a real old-timer, he wasn't talking about 12-volt radios.
Roy.
Yeah, David, I just want to respond to Ed. That's a good point, Ed. Yeah, that's, I don't know. It could have been just a cranky old-timer who, sometimes old-timers can have a sense of humor that's kind of lost on us.
It was a ladder for my guy, N1YDY.
Okay, very good. David, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I thought that you forgot about me here. No, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with the Elinco power supply. I think it works okay, but I'm trying to figure out if there's any noise in my apartment, either the power supply or the refrigerator or whatever. So I turn off all other circuit breakers, you know, except for the one with the power supply on my radio. And then, you know, I was told that, you know, in order to test to see if there is noise coming from the power supply or any other thing, you turn off all the circuit breakers in the apartment and connect the radio to battery. I believe that the noise that I have is coming from, you know, either atmosphere or antenna, you know, all of those things.
Okay, I'm not quite sure if you tried that experiment. Theoretically, if you want to remove your power supply from the equation, you don't have to kill the circuit breakers. You just have to turn off the power supply and plug your radio into a battery, and that kind of does away with the power supply as the variable. Now, if you still have the noise, it could still be some woolwart or some device in your house. And if you cut off all the power and use a battery and you still hear it, then, yeah, it's something external to your house. Now, that doesn't mean that it's a far distant signal. It could be your next-door neighbor who has their power on. It could be a guy who bought some gadget with a noisy woolwart. So, as I mentioned before, woolworts are kind of the big cause of these things, but routers can do them. And a fluorescent ballast can do them, and solar battery charging devices, inverters can do them. So there's a lot of things that may be in your neighborhood that are producing that noise. Other than attacking the source, there's nothing, you can't really choke RF on your side if it's coming from someone else. What you could do is you can choke the RF that you're picking up from local high-energy fields in common mode or reflective powers and such. But if there's some guy with a solar panel two blocks away whose inverter is spewing all kinds of noise, there's not much you can do with choke.
Well, there's tons of noise on my roof. Tons of electrical currents moving through wires. Tons of, you know, possibility of electric motors and other things. So, you know, maybe I should just be thankful for what I have, you know, and be thankful also for RF Squelch. You can have really nice, easy conversations with it.
Well, I mean, one of the many problems of working in a metropolitan area is, and, you know, I mean, hobby astronomers have this problem as well. There's a lot of light pollution that obscures a lot of their vision. And with us hams, there's a lot of electronic devices, both consumer devices in our neighbors, commercial devices in stores and factory near us. I have one of the big MTA yards about three blocks away. They occasionally introduce interesting RF noise on different portions of different bands. It's just the price that you pay for living in civilization. If you ever talk to someone who has a little country house that they go to every so often, who are hams, they'll tell you that how amazingly quiet the bands are when they hook things up out there, because there's very little electronics to produce a nearby noise. And unfortunately, I mean, you know, you could use little methods like having some kind of a signal antenna that tries to pick up local noise and then invert the signal and try to improve the signal to noise ratio. But ultimately, the best solution is either a very, very high gain antenna that you can focus at points where the noise isn't troublesome, or else getting yourself a little country estate.
QSL, QSL. Well, thank you very much, Roy. I appreciate it. And this is a great net.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you for participating. Next is John, NQ1U. Do you have a comment or a question for tonight?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I too am very much appreciative of that. By the way, if anybody has problems with somebody perhaps stealing your automobile, I saw a great sign you could put on the car, which should scare away some people. It says, caution, 25,000 ohms. I thought that was pretty good. Anyway, I hate to change the subject from ham radio particularly, but you started talking about some computer stuff, and I wonder if anybody has comments on how in the sea of HDMI cables you find a reliable one.
Okay, that's a billion-dollar question. Matter of fact, I wish I remembered the particular... There's a Canadian guy who's really into computer, Linus. I think his name is Linus. He's into computer technologies. He tests out new boards and new graphics processors. And this guy, Linus, actually invested in a rather expensive HDMI analyzer device and bought a lot of HDMI cables and tried to compare them all. It's a fascinating series of YouTube.
Well, how about just a brand name? I mean, something like Belkin or, you know, some big name you can trust. Is that simple?
Well, to a degree, but it's not a foolproof type of a thing. Well-known brands usually are more reliable. Now, there's more than a few dozen problems with HDMI cables in general, and that is they are not created equal. There have been a lot of different versions of HDMI, from 1 to, I think at this point, 2.1, and they all have different specs, and they're all capable of different capabilities, And a lot of them are in no way documented on any part of the cable that I could find. So, you know, if you don't remember whether your cable was rated 2.1, and there are different types of 2.1 also, versus some older 2.0, other than having a very expensive analyzer, you're in trouble. Ultimately, unfortunately, and you're not going to like this answer at all, is most people just kind of collect a lot of HDMI cables along the years and don't throw any of them away and just try each one out and seize the best function, the ones that whatever device you're connecting between operate the way you want to connect it. I mean, I would always suggest that you buy name brands and that you also buy using retail outlets that you can return if you find that it's not working for you. But it's still a little game of Russian roulette, especially if you're fortunate enough to have bleeding edge technology. As your equipment ages, there'll be a much higher percentage of different cables that'll still work for you.
Enter Exian.
Yes, Wesley.
Yeah, the subject of HDMI is quite close to me because I was into professional camera equipment for a long period of time. So there were two standards. One was the HDMI cable and the other one was HDI cable. So HDI stands for serial data, digital data interface, while HDMI stands for high definition media interface. So HDMI, both standards are used for the transmission of digital video and audio signal. And here is the problem that sometimes coming on, like Johnson. The HDI signal have a various standards, so there is a HDI, HDSDI, 3G SDI, and 6G SDI. But usually SDI is the coaxial cable. So it's pretty much known for its performance. So there are three types of HDMI cable as well. Standard HDMI cable, mini HDMI cables, and micro HDMI cables. And they will there will be some difference on it, but mostly the problem starts not with the cable by itself, although the impedance for the SDI matters, but with the connectors that are being used. So some people think that if you buy very much expensive $60-$80 piece of 3 feet, 6 feet HDMI cable, you're gonna get a good equipment, and nothing more wrong than that. You can have a $5 one as long as it's made to the standards. So it is also good to rely on the brand name instead of just going with no-name devices. There is a company called Microcenter. Microcenter is in New York, in Brooklyn, and is also in Queens. You can go there and you can choose between different brands if you want to.
Thank you.
Yeah, one is in Kissinger Boulevard and the other one, I don't remember the address, next to the highway to BQE. If anyone knows the address, you can give it to the hams. Enter Exian.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Wesley. Getting back to you, John. I assume there are specific devices that you want to connect using the HDMI cable, and if so, do you have the specifications for what type of HDMI? Does it require a 2.1, a 2.0, or you know, along those lines?
Yeah, I'm interested in an AV receiver and a TV, and they're all kind of new. And yes, 2.1 is where I am, and that's what I usually get. But the other day I got a couple and I plugged it in and it worked for a week, and then it didn't seem to work. And I just, you know, without jiggling the connectors, without messing it physically, it just seems to stop working. So I understand things can be temperamental, but I wondered if I just had a quality reliability issue.
Yeah, about the quality, I think I have something to it.
Okay, Wesley?
Yeah, okay. So we take the SDI is based on BNC connector, we're talking about a connector. HDMI is based on HDMI connector. So the connectors are those who fail or perform. So HDMI uses different connector than SDI cables, and HDMI cables are more expensive than the SDI cables because SDI uses a coaxial cable, usually RG6. And some of the Chinese crab was using RG58 or RG59. It is not that the impedance is different. Dick, remember many times, said that the impedance is not that important in certain applications, but it is simply the way that it is made. Cable length. The HDSDI, so high definition SDI cable, goes to 300 feet, which is usable for digital video broadcasting, while HDMI length is only 30 feet long. So if you want to transfer data more than 30 feet in the HDMI cables, then you need to use the amplifiers or repeaters. Those repeaters or amplifiers are not expensive. The only thing is that some of them need to be powered. Unless you use another trick, which I was using differently, I simply have a balloon that is converting the signal to the RG, looks like a big network connector. I forgot the name on it. The RG6 connector that is on the network Ethernet cable. I got confused. I just don't remember. But anyhow, and then this could give me 600 feet, 800 feet, whatever I want, and at the other side of it, I put again the reverse, which would be from RG45 to HDMI or SDI, and it works like a charm. Then we have a connection speed.
And you and you.
Yeah, I'm gonna quickly end. So HDMI connection speed is low. Then the HDSDI cable's connection speed responds to first you have to establish the connection rather than So it's usually it says that the HDMI speed of transfer data is smaller, but then we have a Blackmagic devices that are extremely fast in transferring data through the HDMI, and they use the ATM switches for it, and it works like a charm. So I'm kind of confused with it. And the last one would be compatibility and cable luck, but I think I'm talking too much, so Dr. Roy.
Yeah, thank you, Wesley. John, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I have to apologize for getting lost, and it seems to be the discussion is morphing into something about RG cables and connection speeds, and that's not what my question was. It was really just about the existing hardware, consumer purchasing hardware, and not various connectors or connection speeds or translating from HDMI to RG. So I kind of got lost, and I apologize for that. Anyway, thanks. I guess I got the answer. I'll turn it back to Roy. This is NQ1U.
No problem, John. Well, once again, if you have the time, if you go to YouTube and you type in, guy's name is Linus, L-I-N-U-S, and just HDMI, the very top of the list is his YouTube that I saw. There was lots of interesting things. It's called I Spent $1,000 on HDMI Cables. And this is where he takes a whole bunch of name brand and non-name brand cables and puts it through the tester and shows people that some of the relatively well-known name brands have kind of equivocal results. Just to confuse and cloud the issue a bit, but it's a very informative YouTube, so I would suggest if you have an opportunity, John, that you take a look at it.
Okay, thanks very much. Appreciate all the input. I shall look into that. This is NQ. Once again for the net. Good work.
You're welcome, John. Let's try a little puzzler. I'll give you the small one first, and we'll see how it goes. Say you got yourself two LEDs. They both look identical on the outside, but one of them is a red LED, the other is a blue LED. Now you take those LEDs and you paint the lens black. So my question for tonight for you people out there is there any way to figure out which one is the blue LED and which one is the red LED? And once again, you cannot see the light emitted from it.
AF2P.
And light switch.
Okay, we have three contenders. I think the first one was FP.
Roger. That's Ed, AF2P. The blue LED will have a voltage drop of roughly 3.2, like that. The red will have a voltage drop of 1.8. So you can put them on the ohm meter and look for those values. Or you can use a power supply with a little current limiting resistor and measure the voltage across them. You won't see the light, but you will see the voltage drop across the lid. That's your right, AF2B.
Okay, Ed, well, you basically answered the question. Would you like to expand on why they have a different voltage drop?
Well, without getting into the physics of it, the material used in the blue drops 3.2, whatever it is, while the red drops to 1.8. That's how I understand it.
BDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Yeah, as was said, the higher forward voltage drop means a higher band gap energy, which means a higher frequency of the light. So the blue, as was stated, the blue LED will have the higher forward voltage drop.
Yep, that's it. I mean, basically, this came out of a discussion that I had with someone of how light-emitting diodes work. Light-emitting diodes are kind of basically just diodes. They have a PN junction, a germanium PN junction has a much smaller voltage drop than a silicon, but both of them emit photons in the far infrared and no one can see them. So in order to have light-emitting diodes, you had to redesign the PN junction such that the band gap. And another way of explaining the band gap is it's the amount of energy required to take a bound electron and raise it to its highest conduction band. So you're raising the energy of an electron, and the photons can be measured in terms of electron volts. And surprise, surprise, roughly a red photon is approximately 1.8 electron volts, and a blue photon is approximately 3.1 electron volts. So since energy is neither created nor destroyed, you have this band gap and this voltage drop, and the diode has to deal with it somehow. What it usually does is it just absorbs it and readmits it as waste heat. But if you put a transparent dome on it and you play around with the band gap so it's in the visual frequency range, you have a light-emitting diode. So that's how light-emitting diodes work, and that's one of the reasons of explaining how different colored LEDs have different band gaps and different voltage drops.
KD2WOT with a question.
Yes, Chris.
So I've seen LEDs that have multiple colors. Is that multiple LEDs in the same package?
Yes. LEDs can operate using different little ploys. One is that you can set up a red, green, blue, or you know, any kind of different LEDs in the same case, and then with multiple leads, wire them so that you can selectively trigger one or the other. Another method that LEDs use is to provide a UV output and then a phosphor that absorbs the UV and emits it as white light. That's what a lot of common light bulbs these days run on. And one of the more fascinating to me is the way that a green pointer, laser pointer, works. And this was discussed more than a few times back when Dick ran the technical net, that most of those pointers start out as infrared LED emitters. They include a rather fascinating crystal that's capable of actually mixing optical frequencies, and they effectively will absorb two photons and put out one photon with twice the energy. They don't do that with a high percentage of efficiency, but it's enough to power a green pointer. So if you have a green laser pointer out there, it's a fascinating design. It has a little optical crystal mixer built into it.
It's a frequency doubler.
Yes, it effectively doubles the frequency, but the method that it uses to double the frequency is it has to kind of merge two photons together to neither create nor destroy energy. So, yeah, you could say that it's a frequency doubler. You could say that it's an optical mixer. They're both accurate. David, you wanted to say something?
I have a topic to discuss.
Question, NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
As the photons hit the blackened surface, do they generate any thermal energy? And if so, is that thermal energy discernible such that maybe the blue would be a higher temp than the red?
Yes, theoretically, if you could, you know, clean up the background noise and everything, you could perceive a higher energy level of thermal discharge from the blue LED. It's a little bit more esoteric. It's much easier to measure a voltage than the thermal infrared output of an object. But yeah, theoretically, you could solve the puzzle that way as well.
I have a problem with your answer.
Okay, Wesley, what's the problem?
Photon doesn't have any thermal energy at all. Photon can interact with matter, and then it could release its energy in form of thermal energy. Right or wrong?
So the matter would be the blackened surface, no?
Yeah, that's how I would see it. It's not going to spontaneously decay into infrared signals. It will be absorbed by the plastic and the black paint and be re-emitted as waste heat thermal energy.
I think I got lost because we were talking together. So we're standing that photon doesn't have any thermal energy. The energy of photon can be deposited to the matter and then it becomes thermal energy.
Okay, Wesley, let me just check that I have it this time. Okay. I was saying that I am not suggesting, nor did Lou suggest, that the blue photons are just scattering spontaneously after their creation into infrared signals. What he's suggesting, and I agree, is the blue light inside the LED that now has a black paint over it will be absorbed by the plastic of the lens and by the black paint, and the energy will be absorbed as thermal energy and dissipated as thermal energy.
Absolutely true. I agree with that. So we need to look at the spectrum of energy versus the wavelength. We say that the higher these, the wavelength, the higher is energy per photon. And to you.
Yes, and as I mentioned, the red light is about 1.8 electron volts, and a blue photon is about 3.1 electron volts.
Thank you very much. I have also a question.
Okay, I guess David is next, and I'll come back to you, Wesley. David, what's your question? Yeah, we'll try one more time. Maybe David stepped away. David, do you have a question or a comment you wanted to make?
QSL, thank you. I was washing the dishes. Sorry, I missed the first call. I have a question about creativity as it is known, okay? Let's say an inventor wants to create something brand new, something that hasn't been created before, and they refer to whatever exists now and also things from the past. So how can they be creative in that way when, you know, they're always referring to the past for ideas and ways to somehow create something new? They can't create something new if they're referring to the past.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
I've been in a situation like that, and the idea is to draw on other items. Find a parallel in some other item and see if you can adapt it.
No, I'm saying you're trying to create something new, but you're referring to the past and what exists now from the past. And, you know, you want it to be new, but, you know, how can it be new if you're referring to the past?
You're taking a very unusual definition of new. Almost nothing in this universe is new at that level. Everything derives from other things.
QSL, and that's why there is so much boredom around. And, you know, I don't feel bored when I go on 20 meters and talk to a Frenchman for 20 minutes.
Wait a minute, these are totally separate subjects.
Roy, you don't have to answer this question.
I'm more than happy to answer this question. I just want to make sure Ed has an opportunity to reply as much as he feels necessary.
No, Roy, do you understand my point? Usually something new is realizing something else totally different can be twisted and bent to do a different job. And you try it, and what do you know? It works.
Yes, I'm saying something totally new. You know, I guess maybe, you know, you can somehow wade through what exists now. You know, you can take the book and read the book and get ideas from the book. But in the end, you know, it has to be like a complete, how to say, like a consciousness, an awareness, where you're basically somehow finding, having another kind of new experience there.
My 5 cents.
One, yeah, okay, Wesley, put your comment in.
Frame of reference. Everything is new. Nothing is old. That means your speech is new, the new second is new, everything is new. It depends from the point of reference we're looking at, what we're standing to, or we're referring to. And at the same time, we may reverse that. So that philosophical explanation would be probably more broadly referred by Dr. Roy.
One uniform.
Yes, one uniform.
Hi, John here. The first comment I think was really a good one. And I'm thinking back to 1675. In that year, Isaac Newton said, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." Well, you see, he saw pretty far into the future. And he invented stuff new, but he admitted that he stood on the shoulders of the giants who came before him.
Yeah, but remember, if it was from reference to something before, then it isn't new. But maybe it's a twist on something, you know, from before.
No, Isaac Newton didn't twist on what came before him, I would suggest. The fact is that it's been said in this discussion already that what has come before maybe gave you some insight. But, you know, take a look at CRISPR, for example. Watson works on DNA, but CRISPR works on RNA. So is CRISPR new? It's dependent upon DNA, but CRISPR is really new.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But, you know, it's from the book. People read from the book. The book could be biased. The book could be faulty, you know. Maybe what they were saying wasn't so accurate, but somehow some teacher, some person liked it and promoted it and made it big. And today we're reading from that book. We don't even know where it comes from.
Can I give you an example?
Finally, Ed.
I was thinking about this recently. When I was a kid, cars had generators with commutators. All of a sudden, they all changed over to alternators. And it was like almost overnight. And I realized what it was. They knew about alternators, but until they had a semiconductor diode that could conduct 50, 60, 70 amperes, it was a pipe dream. The day somebody started selling a 70-amp, 70-conductor diode, alternators became possible and took over the market overnight.
Okay, that's a good example. Let me drop and make sure that I'm by myself here. Okay, very good. Let me put in my little two cents. I tend to think of creativity as sort of climbing a ladder. It goes back to Newton's comment about standing on the shoulders of giants. All of the discoveries, all the creativity in this world that I can think of is based on the natural world. And if it's not based on the natural world, then it wouldn't make any sense to any of us, and we wouldn't be able to have any kind of meaningful discussion upon it other than sitting on a lotus or something. So I think there is a kernel of a previous thought in any great discovery, invention, and creation. Newton created calculus, but you can explain calculus to a person who never learned calculus. So you could say that some of the basic underlying principles are older than calculus and probably be right. The same with everything else. Quantum mechanics is the most confusing thing, but the basis of many aspects of quantum mechanics was discerned a century earlier, which was based on work a century before that, and everything is built up on top of a foundation. There's, you know, you'd have to kind of discover a fifth dimension in order for it to be not directly connected to anything here, but you would probably have to find some connection to make any sense of it. So I think creativity does not require completely new concepts. It can take an old concept and tweak it, adjust it, extend it, reverse it, and do all kinds of interesting things. And there are endless examples from Einstein to Planck, you know, a lot of guys. And very smart guys, and the stuff that they came out with at the time, a lot of people were deeply confused about. But a lot of the basis for general relativity, Lorentz transformations, and other mathematical notations were you know 50, 60 years old at the time. So he didn't invent those aspects. He put them together and set the thing running in the right way to give us farther insight than we ever had about space-time.
K-A-T-U-T-F.
Yes, UTF.
I think the problem with this comment, well, first of all, you have to mention Leibniz together with Newton when you talk about calculus. Just wanted to get that in there. But the problem, the general problem with the nature of this conversation is it's far too general to have any meaning whatsoever. In other words, no specific questions really being posed that could be answered, and a lot of general opinion
close as a result of that. I mean, we all understand that the human enterprise of knowledge is an accumulative affair, and that and was put very well by Thomas Kuhn when he wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, that when all the evidence that piles up in one given under one given paradigm of knowledge no longer suffices to explain things as they are, then there occurs a paradigm shift, and usually moments of inspiration on the parts of great thinkers. But, you know, to say, can you create something originally out of nothing? Does something come out of nothing, or must it always be with reference to something? Is such a generalized epistemological question as to almost be rendered meaningless.
I think that creativity, if it's new, it does not require knowledge or intelligence. It doesn't require anything from the past. You have an experience. That's what creativity is, an experience.
All experience is phenomenologically in the past.
Yes, a lot of people believe that, but I'm not so bored from it.
Back to net.
Okay, I mean, obviously, this is not really a technological question. This is a philosophical trip. It's a matter of, unfortunately, semantics. And of all topics I dislike the most is semantics, because that just causes problems and doesn't cause any enlightenment. David, your concept of creativity is probably different than mine and Gary's and Wesley's and a lot of other people listening. I think you can be incredibly creative by looking at something that we all see and taking it apart and looking at it from a different direction and gaining a great deal of insight. I think general relativity is a brilliant construct that took Einstein many years to finalize. There were a couple of bumps down the road, and actually it was somewhat fortuitous that World War II got in the way, because one of his calculations was a little bit wrong at first, and he corrected them before he published after World War II experimental results that documented it. So I think there have been great leaps of creativity. Some people enjoyed it a great deal. Other people don't understand it at all. And other people are unaware of most creative things. So, you know, but I think this is ultimately a cross between semantics and philosophy.
AUC2PO. KDQYYK, comment.
Yeah, Jeff first, and then YYK.
Hi, how's it going, Roy? You know, being in the lab, I have a lot of opportunity to see discovery, to see not really invention, but discovery, really just basic science discoveries, and to watch that process unfold over many, many years, actually decades. And a lot of times it's really just being in the right place at the right time, an adventitious experiment which yields unexpected results. And the person being in the right place, being curious and intelligent, follows the path, unravels the thread, and finds out really what happened. I think that's different from genuine invention, like Einstein traveling on that train, looking at the clock, and wondering what happens as the photons travel towards him. But I think you understand chemical discovery, and you understand definitely that it's different from kind of the physics, the more ethereal things. Go ahead.
Yeah, I tend to think that there's a whole spectrum of creativity and discovery. At one end are the guys that figured out quantum mechanics, and the greatest line about quantum mechanics is, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics or relativity. But, you know, somewhere in the middle is someone like Alexander Fleming, Sure, it was an accident. The penicillin fungal infection on the petri dish that cleared the bacterial cloud. It probably was some guy with less IQ or less intelligence or less understanding or less intellectual curiosity. They would have just handed it over to have the petri dishes cleaned, and we would never have penicillin. And then there are guys that just happen into it. Their lab experiment goes bad, and they come out with some rubbery material, and they say, geez, it looks like rubber. How do I do this? That's, you know, accidental. So I think there's a wide, wide, wide range. We tend to really idolize the guys who just come up with things that change our concept of the world entirely, where it's mostly going on inside their head as opposed to an interaction with their brains and the real world around them and fortuitous accidents. You know, sometimes accidents can be very useful.
And to exchange with your question.
And, you know, I know one of the inventors of the Cas-CRISPR technology, and really just working hard in the lab. I don't think that stuff was, the sort of light bulb going off over someone's head. Anyway, enough about that. We can go many different directions with this, but I know you want to drive it forward. AC2PL, back to that. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, very good, Jeff. Yeah, sometimes you're just lucky, and that's nice. Sometimes luck and brains kind of add up together, and some guys can just kind of rethink the nature of the universe. And it fascinates me that there are people like that out there, and hopefully there'll be some more that will kind of give us a much better insight into the nature of the universe. There's a lot of problems with quantum mechanics that still needs to be solved. So, we have room for a lot more geniuses out there. Sam, KD2YYK, you wanted to say something?
Enter exchange with you, Christian.
Thanks, Roy. You basically covered everything I was going to say in that last transmission, but I guess wanted to let you know I'm listening. I don't know if you keep a log or anything like that. All right, well, KD2YYK, clear.
G2RY?
Yes, David?
Yeah, I just want to conclude, when you are born, you go to nursery school, you go to school, and in school they tell you that you're going to buy a car, and you're going to have a house, you're going to get married and all that. And you believe it, and most people, they end up doing that, you know. Maybe there is something else. I don't know. Maybe there's something else. Anyway, I pass it back to you. Thank you very much for your words. KG2RY.
Okay, David, thank you for participating. Just as a closing comment, science is a process. And so we don't depend upon the giants alone. We don't accept them coming off of the mountain with stones and graves with E equals MC squared. They have to kind of show their work, and experiments begin from the first minute trying to disprove them. And there are theories that were held up in high regard. Luminiferous ether was thought to be the medium of electromagnetic waves. And some of the greatest minds of the 19th century spent years developing very clever tools to measure the speed of ether. And every single time it showed there wasn't ether. So eventually, people realized that there was no ether. So even though it was a very well-respected concept, if you give the scientific community enough indications and proof that it doesn't exist, then it's written off. Nothing is taken for granted. Even relativity is not taken for granted. There are people setting up gravitational experiments to disprove relativity at close spaces and at very distant spaces as we speak, assuming they're not sleeping. Anyway, with that in mind, I thank you, David. I thank everyone who participated. Wesley, you have a topic?
KA2UTF with a closing comment.
Yeah, sure, Gary.
Remember, just aside from the scientific enterprise, which of course is very important, you need metaphysical